Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Dr. Andrew Howe and I visit with Tyrion at King's Landing to see how he's faring in the Game of Thrones. Surprisingly, Andrew thinks that Tyrion may not be doing as well as is commonly thought. After that, Jim and I discuss our upcoming Fantasy League and auction. All right, without further ado, here is Dr. Andrew Howe. Andrew, when you are reading Tyrion, do you hear Dinklage's voice?
It's kind of unfortunate, but now I do. I mean, I can't imagine anyone else in the role.
Yeah.
I read the majority of Tyrion's stuff before Dinklage, but Dinklage has occupied that role, I think, maybe more successfully than any other cast member from the HBO show.
How do you feel about, I mean, clearly he's an amazing actor. How do you feel about the accent?
I guess it's never bothered me all that much. And neither has it bothered me the fact that he doesn't really look like Tyrion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tyrion having much lighter hair, Tyrion having the mismatched eyes, which are very mm-hmm. much focused on this chapter, incidentally.
Yeah.
And also I think it would have been very, very distracting to have his nose missing, you know, since the end of the second season. I think I'm glad that they gave him a scar instead of, I mean, I think some things mm-hmm. are better visual, some things are better read and other things are better mm-hmm. visualized. Mm-hmm. I think the famous example of that is Galadriel plucking three hairs from her head to give to Gimli, mm-hmm. Didn't translate well to screen. Having this beautiful elven Cate Blanchett reaching out and yanking, you know, tufts of her hair out and handing them to Gimli the dwarf. And so they decided to have that happen off camera, right. famously. So, you know,
it's amazing that anything was edited out at all.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I'm glad that they didn't make that choice to stick strictly to the book. Uh-huh. The accents in Game of Thrones are, I think the only one that really bugs me is Baelish's accent, which really seems to change over
time. That one's really rough. But both wonderfully complex characters who we meet in this chapter.
Yes.
Let me read the synopsis here. Tyrion breaks his fast with Pycelle, suffers no small talk, and commands him to send two copies of a letter to Dorne. Tyrion refuses to share the contents of the message and steals a bottle of some potion from the maester's shelf. After delegating several errands to Bronn, the acting hand of the king meets with Littlefinger and promises him Harrenhal in exchange for an alliance with Lysa and the Vale. Finally, he meets with Varys. Varys has already guessed that Tyrion has led Pycelle astray. Tyrion lets Varys believe that he intends to send Tommen to Dorne and Myrcella to the Vale, if I understand that correctly. Did I get anything wrong in that synopsis, Andrew?
I don't recall that he is going to send Myrcella to the Vale at the end. I could be wrong on that, though. I mean, it is a very convoluted web.
A little odd in that it was a little bit of like rhetorical jujitsu by Tyrion. He doesn't really reveal much, but he lets Varys do all of the work and then kind of confirms it by not saying much.
Yeah, it certainly could be. I mean, of course, this is not the version that comes to fruition, so we'll never know for sure. And it is interesting, you know, why did he tell, you know, it certainly occurred to me that he that he certainly believes that Picel is the mole,
Yes.
because he tells Picel the correct version that he plans all along.
Well, he doesn't tell Picel. What he does is he gives two versions of this letters, and he assumes that Picel's probably going to open one of them, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I guess technically he doesn't tell Picel, but he knows exactly what he's doing and what will happen. He entrusts the version that he plans to follow mm-hmm. with Picel, which I think to me means that he's the one that he suspects has been giving information to Cersei.
Okay, so let me just read this little bit here. If I were the prince, something more I would require before I should reach for this honeycomb. Some token of good faith, some sure safeguard against betrayal, Varys smiled his slimiest smile. Which one will you give him, I wonder? Tyrion sighed. You know, don't you? Since you put it that way, yes, Tommen. You could scarcely offer Myrcella to Dorne Martell and Lysa Arryn, both. Remind me never to play these guessing games with you again, you cheat. Prince Tommen is a good boy. If I pry him away from Cersei and Joffrey while he's still young, he may even grow up to be a good man. And good king? Question mark. Joffrey is king. And Tommen is heir, and should anything ill befall his grace Tommen, whose nature is so sweet and notably tractable... You have a very suspicious mind, Varys. I shall take that as a tribute, my lord. So anyway, in this passage, it looks as if Varys knows both what Picel knows and what Littlefinger knows in a very short amount of time. Because he seems to know what Tyrion has suggested about both the Vale and to Dorne Martell.
Yeah, he could be bluffing, but it does seem like his network in other chapters bears a similar fruit, that he knows things almost immediately. I mean, Catelyn Stark gets off the ship, right, and they're already waiting for her in the first book. You know, she tries to enter in disguise.
Right.
You know, it certainly occurred to me, and I think your interpretation of that passage begs the question, is it really Picel that... You know, I think it is. I think if you read Tyrion chapters into the future, Picel essentially almost admits that he tries to deny it at first. And then towards the end, he said, well, I was only trying to help the Lannisters. But, you know, it certainly begs the question, could somebody who knows that information, like Varys clearly does, he could have leaked one of their versions to Cersei to sort of root them out as the mole, if he really was the mole. So there's a little bit of sort of spycraft going on, you might say, and maneuvering for position.
Right.
You know, I think Tyrion is very clever, but he's not the only one playing these types of games.
Yeah, Tyrion seems confident that this little honey trap is going to reveal to him who he can trust and who he can't trust. I don't know if it actually proves that the other two are trustworthy. I think it just proves to him, I know for a fact I can't trust Picel.
Trust this guy, yeah.
Yeah. Which, as you say, he probably suspects anyway.
Yeah. Now, there's two terms for this. I did a bit of research, and I seem to remember... It's interesting. I remembered the sort of the fictitious name first, which is actually the one that's now become used, which is Canary Trap.
Right, right, right.
I seem to recall in reading Tom Clancy when I was, you know, going through a Tom Clancy phase when I was about, you know, 14 or 16.
As we all do. Right?
before I grew up and started thinking differently about American foreign policy. It came from a few of his books, Canary Trap. There's actually a correct term, when I say a real world term, in American spycraft, it's called barium meal, which is a very strange... It doesn't really roll off the tongue like Canary Trap.
So, did you say barium meal or kneel?
Meal. Oh. And one way they used to, you know, image people to try to look for things like bowel obstructions and whatnot is they would irradiate some piece of food. And then you'd eat it. And then they'd take images at, you know, maybe 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 60 minutes, and they would sort of, they'd be able to, through the, I guess, iridescence, I'm a historian, I'm not a scientist, but they would be able to sort of see where the blockage was. And it, these were called barium meals. Barium was felt to be safe as an irradiated substance. So they'd basically, you know, I don't know, take a brownie and bake barium into it and give it to you. And
yeah, and the only way that that would work is if you get the person to eat it.
Yeah, you have to get them to jump at the cheese, which certainly Picel does. And that's what was that's the term that was used throughout the Cold War, was barium meal. I like Canary Trap better myself, you know, because everyone sings a different song, I think is probably the etymology behind that phrase.
Now, all right. There is some reference to, you know, birds and singing in this chapter. And there's a couple references. Both Varys has birds who sing to him. And then Littlefinger says, yeah, I could sing this song to Lysa, but why should I, right? So there is a reference, but I don't think that the term canary trap is used in this chapter.
No. That's one that... if it is a reference, it's a subtle reference. I mean, he doesn't come out and say it, and I'm not 100% sure that we can read into it that he even knew of that. I mean, it's a concept that predates the Cold War.
Sure.
But yeah, with two different references to birds, knowing Martin, it could be a very subtle reference to Tom Clancy.
So yeah, I like this. So you're basically, the idea is you send out various bits of misinformation into the world and see where it pops up.
Yeah, you tailor it and see who takes the bait, and he doesn't have to wait very long. And I think we see in this chapter Tyrion as a master chess player.
Well, I mean, if you want to get literal, he's adept at the craft of spying. His spy craft is equal to that of the others, basically.
You know, because you see this, but you also see him, you know, swipe the potion that you know, it's never established, but I think the implication is this is what he later introduces into Cersei's food to, you know, basically give her a massive bout of diarrhea so that she's incapacitated and he can assign her personal guard to escort Lord Eddard's bones to River Run and secretly infiltrate a few operatives in to try to rescue Jaime, you know. But we also see that I think he's not quite the master. I mean, that whole plan backfires spectacularly and they all get hung. They all get, you know, killed, if I remember correctly. He also, I think, is a little too free with his information with Varys.
Mm-hmm.
If he's planning to really do this canary trap correctly, you know, so we see evidence of him being a master chess player and also maybe having a little bit more to learn.
I don't know if he's free with Varys. I think he lets Varys believe something or other. But when Varys leaves his room, what Varys believes, at least on the surface, is that Tommen is going to Dorne.
Oh, no, I don't question that. I question... Yeah. The fact that, you know, it should be that the gig is up as soon as he realizes that Varys knows that he's planting three different stories. You know, Varys already knows that. So, I mean, maybe at that point he just can't say anything else because Varys already knows. But he essentially confirms it to Varys. I would just say, oh, your sources may or may not be accurate, you know. But,
part of the game. I think he does have this budding relationship with Varys where they're kind of mutually respecting and offering mutual shows of respect to each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I remember this more from the show, probably because in hindsight they end up on the road to Meereen and they end up in Meereen, and you know that there's a sort of a much longer sort of friendship that develops there. But in reading some of the Tyrion chapters for this book, you know, in preparation to talk about this particular Tyrion chapter, I had forgotten the first time I read this, how Martin does establish this early and really works to bring it along as a sort of a a small little narrative sort of collapsed within this bigger Game of Thrones.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
There's a couple Easter eggs in this, I shouldn't say Easter eggs, but there's a couple what could be seen as minor plot lines in this chapter that aren't part of the major thread, but might be a bigger deal. And the first one that I noticed is that Alistair Thorne is showed up with evidence of the undead. And Tyrion basically blows him off. He's like, let him squirm. We'll let him sit for a while and stew in his own juices.
And this is another reason why I think that we get a hint that Tyrion may not be quite the power player. You know, number one, if the bear is going to send someone on such a journey, it means something. You know, I mean, if you can't trust Alistair Thorne, trust the trust Mormont. Number two, you know, Alistair Thorne is, you know, both in the book and the TV show, is a singularly unhumorous individual. You know, I mean, he's here on business. And if he's coming across an entire continent, it has to be pretty important business. But Tyrion's so wrapped up in his I got to root out this mole that he, you know, ignores. I mean, my memory is that by the time they finally get around to summoning Thorne, the hand is completely rotted away and it cannot be produced as evidence that that there's reanimated corpses that are ready to, you know, overtake the South.
I wonder if this is a failure on Tyrion's part to, I mean, he's been to the Wall, but I do think that he's made some friends up there, but I do think it's almost confirmed his bias that the Wall is an insignificant fighting force doing insignificant things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think he forms that opinion, and you know, it says as much to Jon Snow on the way north. I mean, I think he already has that opinion even before he gets to the Wall, and certainly his time on the Wall, even though he enjoys the company of Mormont and kind of comes to like Jon Snow, doesn't dissuade him from that view.
And then you wonder, like, okay, this is all sort of a domino effect, but the reason why Alistair Thorne is sent south is because Jon Snow and him had a tete-a-tete.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if I remember correctly, the old bear claims, you know, I mean, he can't publicly state, you know, that I have this young up-and-comer that I want to groom for leadership that is having friction with this, you know. The reason he sends Alistair Thorne south is that Alistair Thorne used to be in King's Landing and was a member of the Targaryen court, if I remember correctly. Yeah, and that the reason he's on the Wall that he had to take the black after Robert's Rebellion because he'd been a royalist.
Right.
You know, so there's a sort of a complexity to all of this. And you're right, Martin does this in every single chapter. I mean, there's always multiple layers of the onion to peel.
That's right. Now, the other thing that I noted in this chapter that is significant is that when Tyrion is talking with Littlefinger pulls out the Valyrian steel knife.
Yeah.
And it just says, you know, have a look at it. It's yours. It's your isn't it yours? You know, he said. And Tyrion just thinks how brazen of this man to lay bare his motives. And he thinks, this guy doesn't care if I know. He does not care if I know that he betrayed me to Lady Kat. And that's how untouchable he feels right now. And of course, Tyrion doesn't take the bait. He just moves right on to the Harrenhal misdirection. And it's almost like he's thinking, I can see the bait. I'm not going to take it because I've got my own bait to hook.
Yeah, I'd completely forgotten about the sort of rubbing his nose in the whole dagger episode. And I was very surprised by that. You also get this kind of extended section, you know, it's a full paragraph or two where Tyrion, in the middle of his conversation with Baelish, sort of thinks about, man, this guy's really, you know, he sort of thinks about Littlefinger's career trajectory in the last 10 years, you know, essentially since Robert's Rebellion, and concludes, this guy's way more dangerous than I thought. And I think that might have even been before he pulls out the dagger.
Yeah, we do get kind of a reintroduction to Baelish's backstory, right?
And you sort of get the idea that he already has a network ready to go should he either get Harrenhal or get control of the Vale, or maybe eventually get control of King's Landing.
And right? I think that this is one of the main differences between Tyrion and Ned. In the first book, King's Landing was introduced to us through Ned's eyes, right? Mm-hmm. And he meets Littlefinger, and he cannot shake this idea that Littlefinger is this little boy who was warded at River Run, who Catelyn eschewed, and his brother basically maimed but let live. And it's almost like the fact that Littlefinger is not a warrior of great stature makes him underestimate Littlefinger. And, you know, he seems a little uncouth to Ned. At the end of the day, I think he absolutely does underestimate Littlefinger. Tyrion is not going to make this mistake. He knows that people who don't look like warriors can be very, very dangerous. And so this is why he respects Varys. This is why he suspects Pycelle. And his account of Littlefinger is much different than Ned's account.
Yes, that's a good point.
As we first meet Littlefinger through Ned's eyes, it's like, this is this guy's backstory, and it's a story of failure. When we meet Littlefinger through Tyrion's eyes, this guy is more upwardly mobile than anyone else in this kingdom. In a very short amount of time, he came to court, found himself on the small council, seems very, very astute with money, or making people believe that he's astute with money. And so you get a much different impression of Littlefinger's trajectory through Tyrion's eyes.
Yeah, that his mind is very, very sharp, and is sort of almost can be a weapon.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. Tyrion recognizes the weaponized mind in a way that Ned could never recognize, right?
It's very interesting the way that I think that Baelish, Varys, and Pycelle all put on an act in order, but they do it in very different ways to try to get people to maybe not take them quite as seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, or maybe not. I mean, everyone takes them seriously, I guess, but they put on an act to try to project something, but they do it in different ways. I think Pycelle, you know, it's more clear in the TV show, but you know, I think we see a refrain of it in this particular chapter is that his weakness and ineffectual. I mean, he's pretending to be sort of weak and bumbling. You know, we see that he's very orderly in all of his potions and whatnot. His serving girl is abed with him when they pull him from bed and cut off his beard in a couple of chapters. You know, he's not the sort of weak, bumbling, kind of forgetful fool that he makes out.
Also with Pycelle, he does come across as not having opinions of his own. Whenever he's in the small council, he'll really kind of parrot the view of whoever he wants to impress in the room. And he really comes off as sort of a lickspittle, which maybe he is a bit.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, absolutely.
But he almost presents as someone without ambition, which, you know, anyway, so that's kind of how he projects. And of course, Varys is projecting as maybe more feminized than he really is.
Yeah, I would say a very sort of an effeminate portrayal. And again, it's in a Tyrion, or I think it's usually in a Tyrion chapter where we see he's been sort of down under, you know, walking around underneath King's Landing, and he's wearing a metal helmet and boiled leather, and he has stubble, and he looks more muscular. You know, I mean, Tyrion's like, oh, it's almost like he's a different person. So, you know, he's sort of, we're always being told that he's powdered, perfumed, and plump when he's out in the moving around the Red Keep and whatnot. Whereas when he's underground, he's wearing different clothing. You can see that he's actually quite muscled.
Yeah, and
underneath,
he's not actually,
he has stubble.
He doesn't just like dress the part. He will like, he'll walk differently. He'll like,
he walks differently. He carries a crossbow. Yeah, and clearly he comes to feel comfortable enough showing that in front of Tyrion. And then, you know, going the complete opposite direction is Littlefinger. I think in this chapter, he's wearing a plum-colored doublet with a yellow satin cape. I mean, it sounds like he's, you know, Batman or Robin or something. He's wearing gloves and red leather boots. Mm-hmm. You know, he's being as ostentatious as possible. But I think that also leads people sometimes to diminish him. I mean, part of it is the sort of the laboring under the yoke of being born to poverty and not, you know, having this incredible mind and having these kind of dullard, he calls them dullard Starks at one point, you know, being born into wealth and privilege and, you know, having their future set, whereas he has to scrabble for it. But I think part of the dressing up is not about, you know, this sort of class consciousness that he, you know, hyper-class consciousness that he has. I think it's also to get people to diminish him a little bit and kind of view him as a fop.
And I really think that he's presenting as a pimp.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, yeah. not only because he's dressed as such, but also because he gets Ned to underestimate him by making him think this guy is so carnal. This guy is, you know, so driven by his carnal desires that, you know, he fails to be, you know, a very serious man. So he's all about sex and clothing, and he's into the money of it. When all of that is a guise, he's not really into any of that. What he's into is power. He's got massive ambition that he's disguising with kind of this, dirty and
smutty.
He's presenting as a little smutty guy. And of course, you can always sort of, you know, choreograph what that guy kind of person is going to do.
Yeah, there, you know, when Pycelle clearly opens the letter, the two letters for Rand Martell, it does sort of connect to a couple of things involving the other two characters. I think it's in a later Tyrion chapter in Clash of Kings where Varys gives his backstory to Tyrion about when he was cut and how he survived. And he says, I soon came to learn, or something along these effects. I soon came to learn that the contents of the letters of important men were more valuable than the contents of their purse, you know?
Right,
and so, but we also get the same thing. I mean, one reason why Littlefinger likes brothels so much is he gets secrets from people, you know, and this is why he goes for high-end brothels, I think. I mean, number one, because he can, he has money, but number two, he's more interested in what might come spilling out of the mouth of.
Yeah. He's trafficking in pillow talk as much as he is in.
Yes. High-class pillow talk from important people that he might be able to gain leverage over.
Right. Yeah. People, I guess, let down their, you know, you're in a brothel, you're getting drunk, you're you know, you're letting down your hair in a way that you aren't in other places.
Certainly a lot of the early criticism of Game of Thrones, the TV show, for, you know, the what was the sex position? Sexplanation?
Yeah, sex position.
You know, a few of those were in Baelish's brothels in King Landing.
Right, yeah.
And I can't remember if it's in the early seasons or later seasons, we actually see Littlefinger as a voyeur, sort of watching sex acts through a peephole. And to me, that's not realistic to Martin's vision of who Littlefinger is and why he has brothels. I mean, I think it's very, very clear that he is interested in three women. Has only ever been interested in three women: Catelyn, Lysa, to a lesser extent, and Sansa. But they kind of made him smutty for smutty for smutty's sake, if that's a phrase that we can use in the TV show. Whereas I think in the books, it's very consistently been. He has no interest in sex in brothels. His interest in brothels is all about money and power.
I had a guest on, and she was saying that she doesn't think Littlefinger even has any interest in these women at all.
Could be, yeah.
And his interest in Kat is not necessarily to, you know, to win her hand or win her heart, but to get even. And he wants revenge more than anything. In this chapter, basically, Tyrion is able to tempt him with Harrenhal because Harrenhal is such a massive landholding that River Run occupies his shadow. And that's what he really wants.
Well, I think actually Tyrion, you know, Harrenhal is the Sunday, but I think the cherry on top is Tyrion actually does say that you will be Lord Paramount. You know, that title will shift from River Run to,
right.
So that you will be answering it. Yeah, that's an interesting concept that Kat was at the root and at the site of his greatest humiliation and greatest disempowerment, and that maybe possessing her, and if he can't possess her, possessing her sister and possessing her daughter might be ways of sort of writing the ledger, and that he views ultimately even these women that he claims put on a pedestal as nothing more than objects, and, you know, is completely narcissistic in his drive for power. I'm not 100% sure I agree with that, but I think that is I can definitely see why that argument was made, and I can see a lot of support for it.
I think that you could see something. I mean, look, you could read Littlefinger's origin story in two different ways. You could read it as, here's a man whose love was unrequited, and he's going to do whatever he can to finally play the long game to consummate his desires for Kat or Kat's daughter or whatever, right? So he's a loser, but in the end he's going to win. Or you could read it like, here's a man who was belittled by these high lords and ladies, and he is going to do whatever he can to play the long game to, in the end, go from loser to winner so that they are all underneath him. And so in one way he's driven by unrequited love, and another way he's driven by being humbled and humiliated. And I think it works. I'm starting to think it's probably the second. I really do think that.
And, you know, I mean, it's probably both. I mean, they're both probably part of why he's doing this, I think, right? I mean
I guess if I was going to argue for this, I would say, do I see a major shift in his character once Kat dies? And I would say, nope, he's basically, his designs, his schemes are, you know, only ever get more pronounced after Kat is gone.
But has he transferred that over to Sansa at that point,
right,
as a sort of a younger version of Kat, who can still, you know, who can bear possibly bear children? I mean,
right,
you know,
and maybe he looks more like a young Kat than even
than Kat does, almost. You know? We keep being told that Sansa mostly, but also Rob, look like Tullys.
Right.
You know, that's very much throughout the text. Yeah, I mean, you wonder about what is his long-term plan. If he wants to get control of as much of Westeros as possible, the television show indicates he has designs on the Iron Throne. Uh-huh. I'm not sure the book goes quite that far, but you know, he should be thinking about succession, and if he is, Sansa would be, you know, a logical choice. Catelyn would not.
Sure.
You know, even before she's murdered.
Yeah.
You know, and there are theories, incidentally, about whether or not Robert Arryn is the son of John Arryn or Peter Baelish.
How interesting. Yeah.
Huh. And because this whole he's weak, he's ineffectual, he's tiny, you know, I mean, there's a lot of language that it sort of doubles the two of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. That's very interesting. That's very interesting. Was there anything else about this chapter that you noticed and you wanted to call out?
Yeah, certainly the mismatched eyes of Tyrion's, which are referenced throughout all the books, but they come up two or three times in this particular chapter, which I found to be interesting.
Yeah, he knows that when he fixes those mismatched eyes on just a regular dude, that regular dude is going to feel unnerved by it. And he likes to sometimes use it to that effect.
Yeah, absolutely. He does with Pycelle, and Pycelle cannot look him in the eye. Mm-hmm. But then he notes almost disquietingly that Littlefinger has no problem looking him directly in the eye. You know, I mean, then I think this is almost a visceral, you know, he's sort of intellectually coming to the notion that Littlefinger is a dangerous, dangerous player. And this almost confirms it, you know, that, hey, he can look me in the eye, you know, which is kind of interesting. I think the whole digression with Lady Tanda or Tonda or however you pronounce it.
No, again, yeah, this is clearly a book only detail, but continue. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, we get this idea that, you know, he is kind of competing with these three, you know, King's Council members, small council members. It's sort of outmaneuvering each other while Stannis is sort of, you know, Stannis and Renly are off kind of in the ether. This is what's driving a lot of this, doing their own sort of political military maneuvers. And then we have a third maneuver, which is this sort of game of brides or game of grooms or whatever you want to call it. It's a wonderful, there's two of my favorite quotes in this. One of them is where he says to Podrick Payne, "It unnerves me when you talk to my codpiece, especially when I'm not wearing one." But the Lady Tanda is that he stalked him with a never ending arsenal of lamprey pies, which I think is I think Martin's very clearly connecting these military maneuvers to these political maneuvers, to these maneuvers that are still taking up time. I mean, Tyrion has to, you know, they're relying on the Stokeworths, I think, for a lot of their produce, if I remember correctly, a lot of their food. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So he can't not go and eat with this woman, even though he knows that she's trying to marry. She's trying to marry him off to her 35-year-old daughter.
Well, not only that, but he knows why. He knows that because Lawless is dull-witted.
Yes.
That for some reason that makes her a good match with him because of the way he looks, because of his stature, because of his disability.
Yeah, sort of like an island of mismatched, misfit
yes,
toys.
That's right.
Type reading. I mean, you know, it's just it's like a single paragraph, but it really kind of meshes well. You know, at first I thought, oh, this is, you know, it's just kind of for humor. No, it's not just for humor. I mean, there is a real sort of parallelism to what's happening. And furthermore, I think there are a few subtle references to the French Revolution and the lead up to the French Revolution in this chapter. And I think this is one of them. I mean, at one point he says, I think it's right towards the end, they want bread, not promises. Actually, it's closer to the beginning of the chapter. It's right after they're talking about Lady Tanda's table and all the food that she puts on, and the fact that she's it's her castle is one of the two you know, her land is one of the, it's the Rosby and the Stokeworth lands that are providing all this food. Uh-huh. And then immediately there's this pivot into these poor starving peasants. And then later, fairly soon after, we get this reference to Joffrey shooting rabbits, and they keep escaping, and mm-hmm. Peter Baelish is all, oh, maybe people will be eating rabbit. You know, there's all this reference to food, and you know, mm-hmm. this is, I think it's in two chapters or maybe three chapter Tyrion chapters where we get the riot.
That's right.
In the city, which of course Lawless Stokeworth is brought back into that whole thing, you know, so there's that connection again. So, you know, I think Martin does all this very, very intentionally. He's making these connections between the Stokeworth's food, marriage,
sure.
and that problem for Tyrion that he's being sort of stalked by is sort of, quote unquote, solves itself in the most horrible way possible, in that, you know, that's no longer going to happen after that whole incident.
That's right.
You know, the sort of food, marriage, politics, and violence are sort of introduced in this chapter, and then, you know, there's multiple resolutions in this kind of horrible spate of violence.
Notable introductions. We hear about Holony the Pyromancer for the first time in this chapter, and of course we know the pyromancers are going to be integral to the defense of King's Landing. We also, the Rose Road is named for the first time, which is interesting to me because, you know, of course, these roads to different places in the kingdom have to have names. We've heard about the King's Road over and over and over and over. But surely, you know, the road from Highgarden has to be named, right? So, anyway.
I think it's a symbol that they don't really play a role in the first book, and you know, really are coming into their own in the second book, yeah. and really won't emerge mm-hmm. as a full power until the third. There hasn't mm-hmm. been much reason to talk about Highgarden.
No notable departures in this chapter, but show differences. I noted that there's this, you know, Littlefinger is sort of looking out the window and was looking at Joffrey try to shoot hares, which you just mentioned. And he's trying to do this with a crossbow. And so that's not in the show, but what they did was they brought in... There's this little scene where Margaery is trying to woo Joffrey and he's in his room playing with a crossbow. So I think that scene was probably inspired by this particular detail about how Joffrey's using a crossbow in the courtyard.
Interesting thing. I don't remember if it's in this Tyrion chapter or if it's in, I think it might be in this one, where it's clear that Tyrion gave him a crossbow that shoots three bolts at once. Whereas I think in the show, I think it's Littlefinger that gives him the crossbow, if I remember correctly, which he mm-hmm. then uses to kill Roz, who's trying to, you know, who's an agent in the show.
Yeah, she's spying
for Varys. You
know,
yeah.
I don't know if Joffrey knows that. I just think that.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, she's a show only creation or whatever. But I think what the show is trying to tell us with that is that Joffrey has gone full psychopath.
Well, yeah, no, number one that he's gone full psychopath, but number two, there's the implication if he doesn't come out and say it that he plants the seed in Joffrey and then provides him the victim, you might say, and the victim that he provides is a victim that he knows has been turned by Varys to give him information about what Littlefinger's planning. So he kills two birds with one stone. No, he endears himself to Joffrey by providing this, you know,
sure.
I think he calls it a fresh experience, which is a horrible, you know, I mean, that's the moment where we realize, if I remember correctly.
I don't think I caught that before, but that would make sense if, like, Peter's good at reading people. Like, Peter Baelish knows that this is where Joffrey's going. And so he provides that experience for Joffrey, knowing that he will rid himself of Roz at the same time.
Yeah, sort of, and also endear himself to Joffrey. It's in the chaos is a ladder speech in, I think it's the fourth season of the TV show. And I think it's at that point that we realize that we're supposed to root for Varys, but not for Littlefinger, if we hadn't already figured it out.
Andrew Howe, thank you so much for your time today. This was a delightful chapter, and man, just jam-packed with details.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
Maester Pycelle gets his beard chopped off.
Yeah, he does. That whole, I mean, the Tyrion sequence where he's got all three of them.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, he's got a little canary trap going with the members of the Small Council.
And it's good for multiple reasons. Obviously, it's like he unearths the mole, right? Object number word, you know, priority number one. But priority number two also says, hey, you guys consider yourselves pretty sneaky. And that's kind of like that's your jam.
Yeah, he's sort of putting them on notice.
Each one of you thinks you're smarter than the other, especially me. I gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah.
Baelish is just like so he's just kind of going through the list of like things that are not going to happen now that Tyrion
so
just.
So I'm not going to get a castle.
Tyrion's just imp spreading and just like, no.
Nope.
Not so much. Just so good.
And the exchange where he says, cut off his manhood and feed it to the goats.
Yeah.
And Timmit says, there's no goats. Well, make do.
It's so good.
So, Jim, I've been thinking about this fantasy league that we're creating.
Mm-hmm.
And I could use your help in thinking through the finer points of these teams that we're constructing.
Okay.
Basically, at this point, using a few different people's ideas, we've come up with position categories. Now, if this was sort of like a football league, it'd be like, you know, one or two quarterbacks, you know, that kind of thing, right? So here's, I'll just read them to you and see if these sound interesting or if we're leaving something out or too much or too little. So one undisputed member of Team Black, one undisputed member of Team Green.
Sure.
I think one of each at least.
Yeah. I mean, I would prefer not to have any Team Green on my team, but you know, I'll abide by the rules.
Every now and again, a Team Green will surprise you. All right. So then I suggested one blondie and one not blondie.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty obvious who's blonde and who's not blonde, right? So, but I thought I would expand the not blondie category. Technically speaking, a dragon is not a blondie.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
I agree with
Technically
that.
Technically speaking, if you're bald, you're not blonde, right?
All right. Now we have a debate.
You think all bald people are blonde?
No. But what I mean, they have hair, just maybe not on the tops of their heads.
I think if you're full cue ball, could that be not blondie?
Yeah, you might have some team members wanting to pick some bald people. I'm trying to think, like say I wanted to pick Varys. I know he's not in this show, mm-hmm. but if I wanted to pick Varys for my team. I mean, he has a color of hair. It's just his hair is not present right now. Yeah.
I would say he used to have a color of hair. Varys to me is a clear example of a not blondie.
Okay. So it would just make them ineligible as a blondie, not that you couldn't pick them overall.
So I would say someone like, okay, so Tywin in the books has blonde hair on the sides, but he's got sort of classic male pattern baldness up top.
Mm-hmm.
I think at that point, yeah, he's blonde. Yeah, he's got blonde hair on the sides. You could also sort of say someone had like blonde whiskers, but bald on top.
What about people who are old enough that the blonde has faded and now they just have gray or white hair?
That, see, now you're talking my language. Is gray hair a blonde? My dad's classically Italian.
Mm-hmm.
His hair is pretty well white now. And
mine too.
Right, so, but I don't think of him as a blondie because his sort of the Italian ideal in my head is that he's a brunette.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of goes to, it seems to go to the point you were making.
Right. I'm trying to muddy the waters so that if I wanted to choose someone who should be blonde, but is bald.
All right. Lenore. All right. So Lenore's not dead. He's living happily in Essos. Right. And in order to stay incognito, because everyone thinks he's dead, Lenore must have either died or shaved his head, right?
Okay.
So this kind of gets down to the basic question. Is Lenore, you know, historically platinum blonde, is he a blondie or a not blondie?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that that's ambiguous.
I think so.
Okay. Then we would try, I think... We'd have to come up with a
but
judgment.
But you're making the rules. Yeah, you're gonna ultimately, I think, be the arbiter of this, or the judge.
So. I think
will,
I'm gonna leave
know?
This to Evan. I think sort of like if Evan and the Triarchy decide to make a ruling on this, I'll abide by the ruling for sure. But
perfect.
All right.
But these are the arguments we need to present them.
Yes. Okay. So the other thing I thought we could do with that category, not blondie, was to that's where we incorporate Aaron's The Field. So he came up with this idea that if there's not anyone selected on anyone's team, But someone says Dracarys that's just in the episode, and you took the field, then you get the points for that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, the not blondie, instead of sort of choosing sort of one brunette character, you could take the field that's not blonde. But then you run into the trouble that maybe the person that who says that word is blonde.
Right. Because they're part of the subset of the field.
So I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate the field into this. And I'm wondering if that works.
Well, I mean, you could just rule for the purposes of the field that blondies don't matter.
Yeah, that would be my inclination.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So then we've got Team Black, Team Green, one blondie, one not blondie, one dragon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this has to be a non-human dragon, okay?
Okay. That's surprising to me.
Why?
I guess as a non-book reader, I wasn't aware that there were human dragons, unless you're talking about just generic Targaryens.
I didn't want people to come and say, well, Targaryens are the blood of the dragon or whatever. And
okay.
I wanted it to be pretty clear. When we're talking about dragons, we mean like a reptilian monster.
Okay. Right. Yeah. How about a dragon that can fly? Would that do it?
I don't know. I think that there's possibility of like a sea dragon or whatever. I don't know.
Okay.
All right. So dragon seems pretty clear to me. All right. Next one is, this is sort of standard in fantasy leagues. It'd be like a wild card, or you'd say a utility player. So it'd be a way to be like, if you're fantasy baseball, I've already got a second baseman, but I have this category called utility player. I'm going to select a second baseman, slot them in at utility player. So in order to be world specific, I'm calling this category one stranger.
Okay.
And this could be any character, blonde or not blonde, dragon. You could choose an approved phrase here, or you could choose the field here. So it's basically,
it
brings a little bit of strategy to this, because if I wanted to, I could just keep on piling on the blondies, right? And create a sort of a paucity of blondies for other people, right? So what do you think about this?
So this is, I'm not sure I understand like the distinction between utility player and just like other picks. You know, you have to have your minimum number of blondie, not blondie, team green, team black, dragon. What is the distinction between the utility player and just another pick that I would make?
Yeah, so in order to come up with your starting lineup, you can have one member of team black. That's it, right? And if you want to include another member.
Oh, there's a limit. Yeah. On the number you can field.
That's
okay.
Right. If you want to come up with another member of Team Black, you would have to say this other character is Team Black, but I'm fielding this character as a blondie because they're a blonde and Team Black, right?
Gotcha. That makes sense.
This stranger category allows you to say, yes, I know that I've already satisfied Team Green or Team Black or blondie or whatever. I'm not fielding this player as that. I'm slotting this person into my stranger category.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
I think that this might, I mean, if you wanted to, if you really thought that like dragons were the big point getters, you could say, I'm going to take two dragons and that creates fewer dragons for the rest of the teams. Right. So, and then the other three things that you've got to do is, three approved phrases. So that would give you 11 slots on your roster, 9 of which you have to field each episode.
Okay.
All right. Am I missing something? Is this too much? Should we be, does this leave enough? There are 6 teams. Is there going to be enough characters for each team?
I think so. I think so. You have 6 people on Team Black. the undisputed clause of that might get difficult.
Sure.
But I think we can go with it to start and then revisit it if we need to.
So I think that if you really needed to, like, let's say you just lost out on all the players that you want, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you really needed to field a team, the minimum, you could do it with just three characters, right? And here's how it would go. You'd go, you know, you'd select a character for Team Black, a character for Team Green, a Blondie. For your not blonde category, you could field the field.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the dragon is not human. And for the stranger, you could go with an approved phrase or the field or a dragon or whatever. And then the phrases are not characters. So I think that even if you were only able to sort of win the bid of three characters, you could still field a team.
Yeah, we'll see. I think there are enough characters to leave them at least one option to satisfy these criteria.
Okay. My only other thing I wanted to talk to you about was, what is your relationship with auctions?
eBay.com is about the extent of my familiarity with auctions. So in fantasy football, I've never participated in a fantasy league. So
Aaron mentioned that in board game play, there might be an auction function in that.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Like, so I'm not familiar with this. Would this be like a role-playing game, or how would this come about?
Typically like a board game, typically a resource management game. You would say, okay, I need this particular resource, and so do two other people, and we're going to bid on it. And, you know, it's up to you to determine how important getting that particular resource is and what you're willing to spend on it in order to
get it. So have you ever been in a bidding war?
Sure. In that context, yeah.
All right. And so what's your mentality when you go into these things? Do you feel like, I can't get emotionally involved here? This is how I evaluate the resource, and I'm not going above my price.
I try to stick to that. I'm also a human being, so occasionally my emotions get the better of me. But I think I'm very much stats and math focused when it comes to this stuff. So I say, you know, here's the value of this particular, let's say, in this team member to me. And if I have to spend more than that, I would rather, if the math works out, I would rather take a less valued member for my team and save those points to put into a more valuable member in this other category.
Right. So I think that some people would say, think more about the people at the table and less about the commodities on the table.
Right? Okay.
So what I hear you saying, if you have, you know, if, let's say,
play the player, not the game.
If you're thinking dispassionately, you're probably thinking more about the resources than the commodities. And of course, that I think that there's virtue in that, right?
I certainly think so, yeah.
Let me ask you this. So let's say you're at the table with Aaron and you've known Aaron forever.
Mm-hmm.
Are you more inclined to get into a bidding war with someone like that or less inclined?
Are you trying to plan your strategy with how to deal with me?